Welcome to my live show, Unearth, where I try to simplify environmental news for the average person. My name is Elise St. Clair. I host the show every Saturday morning to teach people about the environment in a fun way. I hope you stick around and hopefully I can help you learn something new. I'm happy you have decided to take some time out of your day to listen to me talk about the environment. I'm really grateful for each and every one of my listeners. For those of you who listened to my last episode, you know all about the rights of nature movement. But if you want to learn more about why nature deserves rights from an opinion-based viewpoint, I published an article in the campus newspaper last Friday about why nature should have rights. So if you're interested, you can read it on the Daily Nebraskan website. On a little side note, I experienced my first ever tornado last Friday, which was really unexpected. It's not great to hear, as someone who hasn't ever seen a tornado, that the storm you're experiencing is historic and unusual. Honestly, that's the last thing I wanted to hear, so that made things a little bit worse, but luckily I was with a friend who's from Omaha, so I was in good hands. I got the full experience of hiding in a basement while watching live storm chaser footage. Somehow seeing the tornadoes through a screen helped ease my nerves a little bit. I suppose the true Nebraska experience would be camping out on a rooftop to get a better view of the tornado, as many people I know were doing. But I plan to leave that to the natives and stick to the safety of my basement. I was pretty lucky that I was in the student union at the time because I just went downstairs to the office of the campus newspaper where I work, and I hung out there until the warning was lifted. So while I was lounging on a couch with my shoes off, my boyfriend had to shelter in a family bathroom with 15 other guys at work. My roommate had to sit on the floor in the basement of a library, and one of my friends had to shelter in a meat cooler. So I consider myself incredibly lucky with my situation. I'm grateful that everyone I know is safe. My heart goes out to anyone who was affected by the tornadoes that swept across the Midwest last weekend. For today's broadcast, I'm going to talk about wolves, ferrets, and bears, hence the fantastic title, Wolves and Ferrets and Bears, Oh My. More specifically, what happens when we try to reintroduce them into ecosystems where they have disappeared. One exciting piece of news related to this topic is that three wolves were sighted in Northeast Nevada in mid-March, or at least the Nevada Department of Wildlife thinks they saw wolves. The Center for Biological Diversity reported in a press release that a helicopter crew commissioned to radio collar moose in the region reported the wolf sighting, after which the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Department of Wildlife worked together to examine footprints and scat in the region, as well as place trail cameras. Footprints, the high desert and mountain mixed terrain, and the prevalence of prey species like elk, pronghorn, and moose in the region all imply that the wolf sighting is legitimate. So the one question I couldn't get out of my head when I read this story was, why are government agencies so keen on verifying the sighting? The answer is pretty straightforward. Wolves are extremely rare in Nevada. While neighboring states have been known for their wolf populations, the most recent sighting of a wolf in Nevada was in 2016, when a singular gray wolf was spotted crossing into the state from a neighboring California pack. But according to Jennifer Solis's article in the Nevada Current, titled Wildlife Managers Report First Possible Wolf Pack Sighting in Nevada in Over 100 Years, the most recent sighting before the 2016 one was in 1922, over a century ago. Unfortunately, over time, a stigma has developed around wolves, and nationwide extermination efforts starting in the late 1800s meant that by the mid-1900s, wolves were almost completely gone from the lower 48 states. Why were people so keen to kill wolves? Well, when settlers first moved out west, a lot of the land that once housed prey animals was replaced with agriculture. Over time, this made it difficult for wolves to survive because their food sources were disappearing. But what was left in their place? You guessed it, livestock. So wolves, being predatory animals that needed something to eat, began hunting livestock because domestic animals became the only prevalent food source. As you can imagine, the settlers weren't super happy with this arrangement, and they began killing wolves in droves. This stretched on into the early 1900s. In the National Park Service's webpage about the history of wolf restoration in Yellowstone National Park, the agency touches on an interesting perspective. predatory animals were targeted because we didn't yet understand how eliminating these species would impact ecosystems. Now today, that seems bizarre. With the wealth of knowledge we have, it's difficult to understand why people were so quick to hunt and poison natural predators, like wolves, bears, and mountain lions, when doing so hurts ecosystems. All parts of an ecosystem are important, especially hunters. Now, over time, we figured this out, and that's why we have species reintroduction and restoration efforts. But we didn't always know how ecosystems interacted, and that lack of understanding was deadly for animals like wolves. The Endangered Species Act of 1973 paved the way for restoration efforts, as it designated gray wolves as an endangered species. 2 years later, in 1975, wolf restoration efforts began in Yellowstone National Park, and the ecosystem began to heal. The effects of wolf reintroduction are still being examined in the park because it had a ripple effect that impacted everything from beavers to trees. But anyway, I don't want to dive too much into that. Instead, I want to point out that unfortunately, the attack on wolves is still an issue, even though hunting predatory animals to near extinction has proven detrimental in the past. That hasn't inspired lawmakers to protect these species. Just last year, Idaho's Fish and Game Commission approved a wolf management plan that essentially outlined the state's plan to kill off about 800 wolves, or 62% of the estimated wolf population in Idaho. Nicole Blanchard's article in the Idaho Statesman, titled "Idaho Fish and Game Proposed a Plan to Kill Majority of Wolves, Officials Just Okayed It," she explains that the plan aims to reduce the population of about 1,300 wolves to just over 500 over the next several years. In recent years, restrictions on how many wolves hunters can kill per season were lifted, and the hunting season was expanded to year-round. If hunting and trapping continue at the same rates they have in recent years, the state will meet their goal. I only use this example because I'm from Idaho, and I remember the outrage I felt when I heard about this plan. I honestly would expect the Fish and Game Commission to know better than to implement a plan that will devastate a population that was nearly eradicated years ago. If anyone should know the effect that getting rid of wolves on such a massive scale will have on Idaho's ecosystems, it should be the Fish and Game Commission. The argument that wolves are a threat to livestock is false, and it was contrived to garner the support of ranchers, farmers, and livestock owners. Yes, wolves occasionally kill livestock, but percentage-wise, the number of livestock animals killed by wolves is practically zero. It's less than 1%. The response to the Fish and Game Commission's proposal was overwhelmingly negative, and petitions and calls for change are still voiced today. And while not all of the wolves in the U.S. are being protected as they should, it is great news that wolves are spotted in Nevada for the first time in several years, because it is a symbol of the progress that has been made in restoring gray wolves to the West as a whole. Another predator that's been unfairly killed by the masses over the last century is the grizzly bear. Just like gray wolves, grizzly bears were hunted to near extinction in the West in the 1900s. But I have good news. That's right, today I have two positive stories. The National Park Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced that they will be working to restore grizzly populations in Washington State's North Cascades. In the National Park Service's public press release, published last Thursday, April 25th, the agency detailed its plans to move between three and seven grizzly bears each year to the North Cascades from the Rocky Mountains or interior British Columbia. This relocation effort will continue over a period of 5 to 10 years until the population in the North Cascades is a stable 25. Unlike the wolf decision in Idaho last year, this decision was made after an extensive public comment period. It is exciting that humans have the capability to restore the population of animals where they once roamed freely, and I'm eager to see the progress of this restoration project over the next several years. Now, this episode wouldn't be called Wolves and Ferrets and Bears, Oh My, without ferrets, which brings me to my next topic. Black-footed ferrets are a wild ferret species, which if you don't know, a ferret is a species of weasel. It's a long and wiry rodent, and this particular species is native to the Great Plains. So what's so special about it? If you guess that it's endangered and nearly went extinct in the 1900s, like the other two animals I've talked about, you'd be correct. Fantastic job. You've obviously been listening very closely. But unlike wolves and grizzly bears, black-footed ferrets are endangered because of poisoning and lack of food. According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service webpage on black-footed ferret recovery, scientists thought the species of ferret was extinct two different times during the 1900s. Luckily, they weren't really extinct either time, and since the 80s, multiple nonprofit, government, and tribal organizations have partnered with the Fish and Wildlife Service to oversee recovery programs for these ferrets. But what I thought was interesting about the black-footed ferret is that there is a rehabilitation program on an Air Force base where ferrets are trained to practice hunting prairie dogs before they are released into the wild. Researchers found that it wasn't enough to breed ferrets in captivity and release them into the wild. Rather, they needed more direction and were more likely to survive when they were able to practice hunting prairie dogs before being released. In partnership with the Department of Defense, the National Black-Footed Ferret Recovery Program has a preconditioning facility on F.E. Warren Air Force Base in Wyoming, near Cheyenne, where ferrets are taught how to hunt prairie dogs and then are released in one of several release sites scattered across the western United States. I also read that these ferrets are being cloned using frozen genetics, which is crazy to me. I've always been fascinated in animal rehabilitation programs, and especially how they function for animals that struggle due to problems outside of hunting. So I had a great time researching the histories and futures of these endangered species, and I hope you enjoyed it to some extent too. Now I know you're all wondering, Elise, what's this week's sustainability challenge? We love doing them so much. Don't fret, I have something for you. I want you to figure out one endangered species that lives in an area near you and just learn about it. Dive into its past, figure out why it's endangered and what makes the animal special. Learn its place in its ecosystem. What happens when that animal disappears? Who does it affect? See what organizations are working to protect them. Maybe this seems really boring to you, but one way we can help endangered species is by understanding them. If we can learn about them, we can be a part of the effort to protect them, either by involving ourselves with these organizations directly or voicing our opinions when legislative decisions about the future of endangered species come up. So go crazy and learn something. Knowledge is power, after all. As we wrap up today's episode of Unearth, remember that environmental news doesn't have to be stress-inducing or complicated. Sadly, this is my very last regular episode of Unearth. But if you haven't gotten enough of me quite yet, you can listen to me one final time for the finale of my show during the 72-hour KRNU Marathon. My special one-hour episode will be airing live on the main 90.3 KRNU station on Thursday, May 16th from 1 to 2 p.m. I'll be working really hard this week to plan out everything I want to include in the one-hour special, and I'll be recording it, and I will tell you that I found a bunch of wild news stories recently that I hope to feature, so you'll definitely want to tune in. I'm grateful for each and every one of my listeners, and I hope you learned something new today. This is Elise St. Clair signing off with the hope that a collective effort to better understand our environment will pave the way for a sustainable future. Stay informed, stay engaged, and stay tuned for my marathon episode on May 16th on 90.3 KRNU starting at 1 p.m. Central Time.